in this case, of course, it's for the betterment of the planet, the betterment of humanity, that we get this right.
Welcome, Davey Slimman.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing well. I'm Jason Cassidy, CEO of Shiny Docs. And with me, as always, Davey Slimman, VP of Customer Success. And with us, as of now, Steve, who just recently had a baby. So congratulations, Steve, and welcome back to work in 2024.
Thank you. She'll be 3 weeks old tomorrow, so it's been a wild ride.
Somebody told me once, you'll start to really love Mondays, and I didn't believe them, and you kind of do. You know, well, any little thing to break up the week is welcome.
Yeah, I find that my coffee consumption went up a great deal. So the coffee growers around the world are the real winners for reproduction.
Big time! Congratulations.
Yeah, I find my coffee consumption was already pretty high. It's been unchanged. So.
Very good. Cool. Awesome. That sounds right in line with the sustainability that I'm going to talk about this week. Very good. Yeah, so this week I'm looking at ESG scores to start off with. Recently, everybody has acknowledged that climate change is a thing. So anybody who it's your uncle at the party who's saying climate change isn't real now is at odds with Exxon and BP and Suncor, like oil and gas companies. I got a quote here that I just read directly from Exxon that said, climate change is real. We have an entire business dedicated to reducing emissions, both our own and others. And Scientific American reports that Exxon knew about this as early as 1977. Yeah. So the graph shows it's up and to the right, like we hope our revenue will be. So
the hockey stick.
So we're hearing all sorts of things right now. It's manifesting itself in the rest of industry as this thing called ESG, environmental, social governance. So we want to have a focus on making sure we have a minimal impact on the earth. We sustain human rights, and the governance that we put in place in our organizations are demonstrating the efficacy that we're not having a negative impact in the world. So that's a good thing. And with that comes a little bit of reporting requirements. Certainly the IFRS. So for those of you familiar with accounting standards, IFRS is just kind of second nature, especially to publicly traded companies. In Europe, there is the ESRS, and substantially they're coming out with sustainability reporting requirements. Sure. And there's real life documentation that is required to demonstrate this. There's some normalization that's happening with respect to scoring. So especially us here in North America, we've been pretty lax when it's come to actually counting the beans when it comes to our impact on the environment. And I'm just kind of curious, does this help the average document management practitioner, the data practitioners, the information governance people, or is this going to be kind of more of a hand waving, look at the trees kind of thing? Are we going to be very rigorous with ESG, or is it going to be something fairly loose?
Well, we shall see. The good news is, from my perspective, the governance part of this is something that organizations of any size all over the world are already accustomed to. This is just a different set of reporting requirements associated with a different set of objectives and outcomes. But any industry or any company that operates within an industry that is already regulated won't necessarily find this different than other governance activities that they're already undertaking. It's just additional, right? So it's additional and over and above what may have been done by an organization in the past. And certainly, I think it's welcome for a lot of people. And then of course other people will be responding to this as being, you know, kind of another layer of bureaucracy or red tape. Now, in this case, of course, it's for the betterment of the planet, the betterment of humanity, that we get this right. And so I think if you are an organization that falls into this category that will require these levels of reporting, it's not optional. Presumably there will be some teeth added to these regulations, so that organizations who fail to comply with the requirements of you know, whether it's new legislation, new regulations, etc., they will presumably be fined or be subject to fines until such time that they get their act together. So I you know, good news side of it from my perspective is that, you know, document managers and information managers and people that have been, working at this for a long time, not in the sphere of, you know, greening the planet or making the planet a more sustainable place to live, but perhaps maybe, governance associated with safety, governance associated with other financial regulations. For example, if you're a publicly traded company, you have a ton of things that you need to report on all the time. And so this is additional to that, but it shouldn't be new to people. So that's my sense of it. And I've done a little bit of reading on it as well. And of course it seems to be very, very different at the moment from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. And I'm sure that some of that will also level out over time, and there'll be a sameness to what needs to be captured. So, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, because it's like, as I do my research, and my research is literally nothing more than Googling and Binging and ChatGPTing this over and over again, and then going to IFRS directly, looking at the document requirements, and that it does seem a little loose right now. Like, certainly you can phone PwC or Ernst & Young or any of the big consulting organizations or Deloitte, and then they will guide you to an ESG score. I'm hoping it becomes something more obvious than that, that we can have kind of the QuickBooks version of ESG at some point in the future, where it's obvious that this is just what you need to do. This is how you count the beans, and this is how you report it.
Yeah. I'm trying to avoid taking a cynical view of it, so I apologize if it comes out that way. But I think if it can be set up in such a way that organizations don't undertake this as a kind of, you know, a greenwashing is kind of the common term that's used, you know, to apply a green veneer over something so that you can check a box to say that you've met a certain, threshold for your organization. If it is set up and configured in such a way so as to have some real, as I say, teeth or value or impact from the point of view of, you know, a failure to comply results in some kind of negative consequence for you, whatever that may be, right? I think that's when you'll start to see some real movement from organizations who will simply say, look, we got to do this, because if we don't do this, you know, maybe it's not a question of fines or anything, you know, of that sort, but maybe you're not open to certain types of government funding or government investment. Maybe it has an impact on you in some other way that is also negative. And so that kind of spurs you into action to meet the level of compliance that they're looking for. That's been, I've noticed lately, not just here in Canada, but I've noticed examples of it crop up around the world lately, where rather than seek to penalize a company for failure to comply with some new government regulation, because the courts themselves may be really, you know, arduous, long processes and expensive and not really getting the results that everybody wants anyway, the governments around the world are simply saying, okay, well, if you're not going to be compliant with this thing, then your organization really is now closed off to this other set of goodies that we might have offered you, investment, right? So I think that's another thing. It could become a barrier for people who are not compliant to get access to things that they want to gain access to, which is an interesting approach. It's not the same thing. It's kind of the the carrot rather than the stick, rather than, you know, beating people over the head with a, with some kind of a commercial penalty or a fine levied by the courts, you're essentially saying you're not going to get access to all this other fun stuff that we have available. So.
Yeah. And like, I mean, governments lately don't have a great track record on being immune to whatever lobby is encouraging them to act on behalf of whatever commerce is happening. However, the consumer itself, I'll look over at Steve, you're a principled and discerning consumer. At what point does it become common that people are looking at the ESG score of a company to decide whether or not they want to purchase from them?
I think that's a really good question. And I don't know if it's a generational thing. I'll admit that it's something that necessarily myself doesn't put like a lot of weight into, but I know people of a slightly younger generation than me that like that sort of score carries a lot of weight with their buying decisions, or their really understanding kind of like the background of companies and what companies like stand for these days. And I think it's a good idea. Like, I don't think I go a day without seeing some sort of headline like the Doomsday Glacier is melting, like how it's going to affect all of us. So, you know, as I think in you know, a current climate of climate change denialism, that something like this is going to help kind of, you know, bring it more to the forefront. And we're going to see more people, again, especially I think in younger generations, that are putting a lot of care into
I think
that.
That's, if I may jump in, I think that's a very astute call out, Steve, about generationally what's happening. To tie it to something that I have read about that sounds like it's not related, but actually is completely related, we are seeing more and more examples, even in this kind of challenging economy, situations where recruiters are having a difficult time recruiting for certain positions because young people are choosing not to go work for industries that they associate as having a bad track record with the climate, with climate. In other words, you know, they're interviewing, they're having, you know, job offers sent their way, and they're choosing not to go in those directions because they either ahead of time or during the interview process discover that, you know, that the organization that they're interviewing with has this lousy track record, and they're choosing to self-select out and say, no, I'd rather not work for you than work for you. And I think that's another really interesting thing. I don't, you know, I'm squarely in Gen X, you know, and I don't know that was exactly true for us, you know?
And yeah. And we've even experienced that here with Shiny Docs. Yeah. Like, it's back when we were closer aligned with OpenText selling something additive to them, which we are still doing, but I mean, it's less and less every day. There was lots and lots of oil and gas and utilities. They were quite big in that space. And now we're selling way more to municipalities. We're selling to law firms and legal departments in that it's, we can certainly, like, we veered away as the buyer has changed for us. And it seems like that's for the better. We don't have to justify. It's like, oh, well, I'm sorry for having Suncor or Husky or somebody like that as a customer. It's like, to me, it's okay, because sitting on my desk are still lots of plastics and there's lots of stuff. So it's not like this industry is going away. Right. I just like, you know, fairly keeping score.
Yeah.
If it's hurting the environment, then what are we doing about it? That's the trick is the threshold for me. I can't claim that tomorrow we're going to eliminate the generation of oil, gas, natural gas, and these other things. Let's use them responsibly and minimize them where we can.
Yeah. To maybe put a little bit of a bow on it from the perspective of, you know, I am and, you know, where we come at the problem in terms of helping people understand and manage their own content and their own data that may be subject to these, you know, future requirements. I think the key for its success will be doing everything that can be done to make it simple and consumable for people. I think that, you know, the success of this kind of program really will depend on having something that, you know, even among people who have time to devote to it, it has to be the kind of thing that could be implemented easily, understood easily, and consumed easily by investors, stakeholders, shareholders, employees, consumers, so that, you know, so that it's not, you know, some 75 layer deep, you know, taxonomy of explaining whether or not a company is compliant with something or not, you know. So to the extent to which these programs can be made simple and clear, I think that'll be the indicator as to whether or not they actually have any legs to them, you know. Yeah.
That puts a bow on it.
Yeah.
Does that segue into your first
topic? Well, kind of, you know, like, so, cause I, you know, we've touched on it a couple times before, even outside of this podcast. I'm really interested in topics related to trust, and, you know, kind of, trusting your data, and being able to demonstrate that others should have trust in your data. And, you know, you may not remember, but like, a couple years ago, maybe it's even longer, you and I and others had some conversations about why is it with blockchain, right? So remember, blockchain, everything in the world was blockchain a couple years ago. Now nobody talks about blockchain as much because everybody's talking about AI now. So blockchain's like old yep. news or something. But I remember at the time, you know, I think, well, it was you who said, why are we not blockchaining all of our files and documents and data so that we can, from a chain of custody perspective, from a data provenance perspective, and ultimately from a defensible disposition perspective, why are we not blockchaining all of this content so that we can demonstrate through the entire life cycle of a Word document from the, you know, from the moment that I create a Word document to, you know, 8 years from now when some records manager deletes it, why are we not applying, let's take blockchain out, why are we not applying some methodology to it to ensure the trustworthiness of this data from the beginning of its life to the end of its life? And so that's how I'm going to connect it into your topic, in that I think when it comes to, you know, seals of approval or gold stars or stickers that we're going to give to organizations that are meeting a certain level of compliance for their, you know, for their commitment to combating climate change, we need to have a way of trusting the reporting coming from these organizations. And so that's the topic I want to bring. So it is tied to yours, if you'll allow it.
For sure. And I certainly will allow it. And I don't want to challenge it up front, because it's like we say, we shared this idea, I'm going to say, a few years ago, back when blockchain was exciting. And as I had time to reflect and try to sell the idea to the right people, is one thing that's interesting is that it is so easy to, when it comes to something like ESG or something like that right now, it's so easy to just make stuff up and load out some data. Right. And that fraud detection itself, like, people don't even consider that to be fraud. They consider it to be a best effort. Yeah. Whereas a financial transaction where I vector some money out of your bank account into my bank account, that's no fraud. Oh, you get the white collar slap on the wrist for doing that. Whereas to kind of do a best effort at how much we polluted the, you know, the overflow pond, that's kind of good enough these days. So until we are met with the same level of scrutiny, the idea of you know, like an ESG score or something like that, and until that is perceived as by polluting or, you know, violating human rights or whatever, if that is perceived as being equally or more villainous than actually stealing money from somebody's bank account, then we don't need blockchain. So I hope I articulated that right. A blockchain eliminates the idea of this fraud, because for sure, this is the state of this transaction at this time. Unambiguously, everybody can compute it. It's all sitting out in the open. Mm-hmm. That's what makes blockchain powerful. But as far as doing that for, was this the exact document that supported this exact thing at that time? I mean, the document itself could be fatally flawed when it comes to supporting it. So yes, it was the right document, but who cares? Because the data in it was completely wrong and all that. So it's got a weird nuance to it that for some reason we're more pissed off if somebody walks into a store and steals a candy bar than we are if they go and dump a tank of gasoline into the river. Right. And I don't get that because one of them, like one of them can literally kill things and the other one can't. But for some reason, one of them is more highly valued to society than others.
Is the problem humans? Of course the problem is humans. So the answer, the problem is always humans. But I guess what I'm getting at is
humans.
Please
subscribe. We love humans.
Like anyway, you know, and I'm going to connect this into like the Internet of Things and all this other stuff. But like, if you progress 20 or 30 or 100 years down the road and every single piece of hardware or every asset that somebody has a measurable value associated with it or some kind of sensor or some kind of, you know, some kind of something that is measuring and reporting on it. The truck that's full of the toxic chemical has GPS, the little valve that you can open to spill the toxic chemical into the pond has you know, some kind of device attached to it. Like, are we going to get to the point where it'll be impossible for somebody to take their truck at 3 a.m. to the pond and unscrew the, you know, the valve and dump all that pollutant into the pond because the whole thing will be tracked. And that data associated with that is also going to be immutable or unchangeable and not fudged in some Word document. Do you know what I'm getting at? Like, I think the problem up till this point is that humans with little clipboards and pens are saying, yeah, I took the truck down the highway and it took us 3 hours and we didn't stop along the way. Checkbox, checkbox, checkbox. And human beings are the ones that are taking the side road and dumping that stuff where they're not supposed to dump it and that kind of thing. And we can solve for this is what I'm saying.
Yeah. And there's this behavioral psychology associated with that. Like there's the combination of two things. So every time you have two variables in a problem, it becomes difficult. Yeah. And as soon as you introduce third or fourth or fifth, it becomes untenable. Problem number one is like diffusion of responsibility and diffusion of victimhood. Like who's the actual victim under the circumstance where somebody dumps whatever into the river, or into the pond? Yeah. Is it all of us? So there's a diffusion of who the victim is. It's hard to really identify. Yeah. Whereas, you know, like it's the candy bar store owner when you steal the candy bar. There's one, there's no diffusion. There's the diffusion of response. If a corporation dumps something, then is a corporation a person? Well, the Supreme Court of the United States said it is. But do we hold a corporation accountable the way that we would hold a single person accountable?
No.
If a single person is burning tires in front of my house, I will stop them.
Yeah.
If thousands of people are doing it, then what can you do? You know what I mean? Yeah. Like so there's the kind of the diffusion of responsibility, and it kind of intersects with this idea of on both sides of who's the victim and who's the perpetrator. If you diffuse the perpetrator, then it's tough to identify. Well, did anybody along the chain really make a bad mistake, or is it anybody's real fault, or did they just act in their best interest the way they thought they should? And there's no real victim anyway, because the pollutant only killed ducks or something. Like, I mean, it's, you know, it's
right.
It's,
and I mean, even
these are the kind of weird rationales that people use.
You know, I'm also extrapolating out kind of decades and even centuries, because I think in the very near term, you know, applying sensors to valves on trucks doesn't solve anything, because, you know, people who are up to nefarious acts find ways around those nefarious acts, no matter, you know, so putting a valve on the truck, they'd find a way to turn the valve off or turn the sensor off or something like that. And so, you know, as long as we have you know, humans involved in this kind of activity, I think you're going to be susceptible to, unfortunately, you're going to be susceptible to bad actors. And what you're trying to do with technology and what you're trying to do with regulations is to limit the impact that those bad actors can have, you know, or at least to try to have some kind of consequences for those actions. So, we did bring it back into the, you know, we connected the two there, but I don't know that we solved that one.
And Steve, did we make a point? I think we explored something, but I don't know that
we resolved. The provenance of data one is something, the provenance and the chain of custody stuff. Chain of custody in legal terms is always super interesting to me because, like, you know, if you think of like a, you know, my wife watches all kinds of like murder mystery documentaries and listens to a bunch of podcasts and stuff like that. And chain of custody often comes up in the context of like, did the murder weapon that the police found on the scene, what was the chain of custody of that murder weapon from when the police picked it up all the way to the court case and the lawyer holds up the, you know, the candlestick or whatever the person used, you know, was can the police and the prosecutors guarantee that the chain of custody was unbroken during that time so that nobody came in and tampered with anything and that kind of thing. But the reason why I mentioned that as an example is that it can and should work the same way with our documents and our files in terms of information management. And I think we as an industry do an okay job of that, but I really feel like it's still kind of best effort right now, even today, that, you know, it's like, well, yeah, but, you know, somebody took it and they kept a local copy and then they edited a bunch of stuff and then they uploaded it back up and then somebody deleted the audit log for that thing and whoops, you know, then it still looks like that document didn't change, but maybe something materially did change in that document. And we don't really have a great way of being absolutely sure that that was or was not the case. And I guess what I'm saying is I'm actually a little surprised that that alone hasn't bitten more people than you'd think. You know, for example, a number of times that, you know, things like emails and chats and SMS messages are brought up in court cases as part of the court case. I am a little surprised that the kind of assured veracity of those objects hasn't at times been questioned. But, you know, maybe that's a level of complexity that courts aren't really that interested in going into. I don't know.
So I don't know about you guys, but I was a junkie for like the Johnny Depp trial last year, whenever it was. Right. And I know there was a lot of evidence like that. There was introduced like, you know, text messages and like things like that. And there does seem to be a pretty robust kind of like industry now for like forensic analysis of that sort of like information.
Good. Well,
and I know there was some, it was brought up a couple times because like, they were able to prove like pictures from phones that were entered into evidence were not like the original. Right. It was like a picture that had been like sent to someone. And that's like, that was able to track what you're talking about, that chain of evidence.
Great example, right? You know, my daughter, you know, she has my phone for 4 seconds and she's into the pictures and she's modifying them and adding little hearts and, you know, emojis all over them and that kind of thing. Like, you know, these things can so easily be modified and altered. And I sometimes think that we take a lot of this too much at face value and the trustworthiness of it can be lost, I think. So.
Yeah. And I mean, like in a world now with like deep fake and stuff like that, it's going to just be increasingly like far more increasingly difficult to validate or trust anything you see.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like it. So it doesn't segue at all into my next thing that I was going to talk about. And that's okay.
That's okay.
Is that this is a simple one. It's data footprint. Yeah. And I've seen this 2 tons of carbon dioxide per year per terabyte of storage.
Yeah, I've seen that.
Which kind of it's 5 watt hours per terabyte. And so the idea that it costs real electricity to keep real data active for people is, so it just flat out costs you money. It flat out bad for the environment. And there's all sorts of governance reasons why you probably want to get rid of personally identifiable information or whatever, if you don't need to keep it anymore. So this whole idea of reducing your data footprint is something that we're selling right now. We do have customers who brag about it once they've done it. And I'm just kind of curious to explore the, like, obvious, to me, that's an obvious checkbox for ESG score. Yep. So woohoo. So that's a fantastic one. And the idea of making people more productive by reducing the noise, an obvious one. However, it's not really a number one use case for people when we talk to them, despite the fact that, I mean, we're pretty inexpensive. Yep. It's an A use case. We just do it. So the idea of saving tons of carbon dioxide per year, saving 5 watt hour per terabyte, and reducing the overall data footprint. It's interesting to me that that's not highlighted as a high priority right now for your typical IT person.
Yeah, I wonder whether it's that, you know, keeping the lights on in a building, for lack of a better expression, is something that's so opaque for so many people within an organization. There's you know, I'm not even sure that in a lot of organizations the CIO knows what that bill looks like. I suspect the CFO knows what that bill looks like. The cost of keeping your facility running, of keeping the air conditioners going and the heater running, and obviously all the electricity that's going into the building to power the data that you're storing. And if you're storing way more than you need to, as a CFO, you want that to be less. You know, if you're looking at a monthly electricity bill that's $2 million or something for your organization, monthly electricity bill, $2 million or something like that, and there are things that you can do to make it less than that, as the CFO, you want that. You want that to be smaller. I don't think, you know, the CIOs, and certainly not the business users, have any necessarily any visibility or focus on that. You know, they just view that as the operational cost of the company. And I'm being a little mean to CIOs in this case, because I think in many cases they actually do care. But I guess that, to your point about, you know, who we're talking to and who we're selling to, we're not having a lot of conversations with CFOs. If we were, maybe that would be a point that would really grab them. Say, hey, look, what are you spending on electricity right now? You know, how much of that is your data? And how does that change if we can change the data footprint of your organization to one where, you know, you're currently keeping, you know, 2 petabytes of data warm in your data center, and we can shrink that down to a third of that. You know, those can be some real numbers, right? So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I do think it's a powerful narrative to explore. And, you know, I defer to, gentlemen, your expertise, but being relatively new to the space, like, you know, working in this kind of information management space for a little more than a year now, I was completely oblivious to that sort of, like, narrative. Like, when I first discovered that, I was like, wow, like, sure. And Jason, I do think this segues back nicely to kind of that first topic about, like, the ESG scores and that. Okay. Because I think maybe a lot of people in a position like me, you don't think about that necessarily, and you don't think about, like, you know, how, I like the analogy of warming that data in kind of your oven, how, like, I don't think they realize that they left the house and they left the oven running. And, you know, that's like kind of upping the cost. So I do think that that's an interesting narrative that I think should be explored further, because I found it resonated with me, like, as far as even the, not just, you know, reducing your data,
this
footprint,
is,
but
this
reducing
is,
your carbon footprint.
This is also an interesting topic. Given the times that we're in right now, when times are going great and there's money to burn, and, you know, everything, the economy's, you know, buzzing along and everybody's making lots of money no matter what they do, you know, okay, you leave the room and the lights are on, you know, all these choices that people make. But when you're looking at every dollar that's leaving your business, there are two lines that you can play with in a business: the top line and the bottom line. The top line is the money that you've got coming into your business. The bottom line is the money that you're spending. You know, you can adjust only two lines. You can bring more money into your company, or your organization, or you can let less money leave your company every day. And those are the only two levers you've got. And so if we're in a situation where the top line is not looking great or it's not growing as an organization, then you've got levers on your only lever left is the bottom line. It's like, how can we spend less money? Well, one of the ways you can spend less money is not, you know, keeping petabytes and petabytes of data around that you don't need anymore, you know? So.
Yeah, it is an interesting one. And I think like there's nuance to it in that you turn off the lights in the plant and nobody can see and they bump into each other and obvious hazards associated with that. You turn off the lights on some of your data. Like I was talking to a CIO of a big bank recently. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that he was saying is like, when it comes to a lot of the unstructured data that's out there in file shares and in SharePoint and other locations, knowing what it is and acting decisively on it is untenable, I think is the word that he used. And there's still that perception out there that it's really unknowable how it will bite you if you get rid of a piece of data. So you kind of hoard it just in case it's useful at some point in the future. Which as we know, like Davey, you know, and your team knows better than anybody, like you can save people 60% on storage. Like, I mean, it's literally duplicates, trivial files before you even make a hard decision. You can get to 40-60% of your data that can be completely eliminated. So it is interesting that just because it's not as obvious as flipping off the lights and watching people bump into machinery, then it scares people. I'm not going to delete the data because I never know exactly what it is or where it is or when it might be used in the future.
So this ties to the third thing that I had jotted down for this session, which, you know, Jason knows this, Steve, I don't know whether you know this about me. I'm actually a librarian by profession. I started my career long before software as a librarian, briefly working in an actual library before making the jump to the tech industry. And it got me thinking about, you know, librarians versus records managers versus people who work in museums, right? My wife works in museums, and in fact, she comes from a family of museum people. And, you know, librarians, they keep everything that people are using. It's incorrect to think that librarians don't get rid of things. Librarians throw out books all the time. They, you know, they recycle books, they donate books. Librarians do not keep everything forever. They keep stuff that people are using. Records managers keep everything that they're required to keep, that somebody has said to them, either through policy or regulation, you're required to keep this, whether people are using it or not. In fact, the utility of it is weirdly irrelevant for a records manager. It's just that you've got a requirement to keep something. And, you know, and then, you know, if you look at museums and museum people, they keep everything that is interesting or that advances knowledge or human understanding. And so, you know, if you try to make the jump of, you know, librarian records managers or, you know, museum folks, you know, you try to apply that to, you know, organizations and business and like, obviously records managers are required in a lot of cases to keep things that have to be kept, but only that's all they care about, whether it's useful or not. The librarian side of it is, let's keep the things that are actually being used and useful. And I think the meeting point of those two is where people should find themselves. So if you find yourself with 6 terabytes of data, figure out what you got to keep. That's the records management side, and figure out what people are using and keep that stuff. And then everything else, it's got to go, you know? But I'm known to be a little ruthless in that regard.
I think that's really powerful, Davey. Like, right away, my mind goes to, could we have a UI in our software that says, are you in librarian mode? In librarian mode, hear me out. Like, it is, we can determine how the frequency at which people are using things. We look at last access date, last modified date, these types. It's how many times have people search for this? That's librarian mode. No searchy equals no keepy. Whereas, the records management mode slightly different. It's like, does this match something that we're required by policy or law to keep? Then we got to keep it. And you flag it as records management mode. Yeah. In literally everything else, if it hasn't been touched in 5 years and it's not classically considered a record, kaboom. Yeah. That would be awesome if even if our software literally just told that exact story the way that you told it.
You know, it's funny too, because I think it's also wrong to assume that it has to be destroyed or deleted. There, you know, Jason, you probably know better than I do, but there are businesses out there that will absolutely sell you, you know, low cost, low speed data storage, right? So, like, you know, it, you know, you, it's probably pennies on the gigabyte. You know, it won't be a lot, but essentially you can buy storage in the cloud that you really only access occasionally. If you really don't want to delete something, but you also really don't want to have it clogging up your users' lives, send it to one of those centers and have that be part of your story. So, well, we didn't delete it, but it's in this place that's, like, you know, off to the side, and we're paying a lot less for it. And I think that's a story that a lot of people would also, but I don't know that people know that that option exists for them. Right. So,
yeah, it is. It's the classic tiered storage. Yeah. We've actually built software that supports it. Like, I mean, yeah. It's so our search interface, you can search across multiple documents. Yeah. And it doesn't matter if it's in the cold storage or in the fast storage, we audit whether or not it's been used, and of course can promote it back into hot storage or whatever. And lots of people love the story, mm-hmm. and there's some people who've actually bought the story as well. And that's great. But for every 100 people I talk to that love the story, there's one who actually implements that story. Like, it's rare for somebody to actually go to that level.
Is it just perceived as too much work, or like they don't want to, I don't, you know,
it's not even, it's weird. I think, it comes back to all the way back to the introductory topic of trust, mm-hmm. is that, am I going to trust that I'm going to put the librarian desirable thing and the record thing into the cold storage? Maybe that's a bad move or whatever. It's too untenable to think about. And I feel like that's where we get what I'll call bunged up with customers, is that they have a hard time making that decision. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's the whole point of you letting them off the hook by saying, you know, we're going to put in the slowest possible, cheapest possible storage, and then we'll track. And if nobody searches for it for 5 years, then we'll delete it. So you get cost savings, you get ESG score, and you get less carbon dioxide. You get win, 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 win. And then we do it. It is, you'd think it would be more popular. Like, I mean, it's a capability of the software. Yeah. It's something that we can do. And lots of people are intrigued by it, and they tug at the string, but the number of people who actually implement it is not a ton.
Do you think it's wrapped up in, you know, this is bringing it full circle to the trust topic, I think, is, do you think it's wrapped up in people's ideas of the ownership of this stuff that, you know, every one of us, when we start, like, certainly most people who start any organization nowadays sign something in your employment contract that says that all of the stuff that you do in your job doesn't belong to you. It belongs to the organization. It belongs to the corporation. Your laptop and anything you type on your laptop doesn't belong to you. It belongs to the corporation. Everybody signs that. I probably signed something like that when I joined ShinyDocs. I don't know. I didn't read the fine print, but you know, yet every customer that I can think of in the last 10 years, even before coming to ShinyDocs, when you talk to them about some of these IAM topics, they're like, well, this is my stuff and this is my data. This is my team's data. And I don't know, just because finance is doing that with their data doesn't mean that I want them, you know, we're HR. We do stuff a little differently over here. I don't want the same thing happening to our stuff. It's like, well, it's really not your data. Know that you think it's your data. It's not. It's the corporations. It's the organizations. So is that the mentality that needs to be changed? Can it be changed?
It is a real thing. And I mean, it's almost like we're introducing.
I know. I'm sorry about that. Yeah.
Yeah. That's okay. That's okay. That's the whole design of this format is like a document, a drawing. Yeah. A piece of media, this podcast is art.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Well, it is, it, despite the fact that it might be owned by Shiny Docs Corporation, federally registered and whatever, it's, who cares? It's, this is our art that we're putting together. It's some original thoughts that we're putting out there for, that we believe that a market has value. And the level of ownership that people have over the art that they create, even if it's a contract, even if it is, and I don't mean to trivialize contracts, you can pour your heart and soul into making a good contract for an important deal. But yeah, people feel far more strenuously attached to that than they do for, ooh, that Salesforce transaction there, that's mine. That's where I closed the $1 million deal. It's like, no, nobody gets too fussed about the database entry for the whatever transaction. But for some reason, when you create that art, you got the logo in the top corner and you got your name on the cover page and you did a couple of the graphics or
you
whatever.
Did all that work. I did all that's
It's like right there. It's your reflection. So of course people feel far more attached to it. It's my research, it's my data, it's my document. And it is, it's part of it. And I as well too, like I'll always bring it back to, these are multivariable problems. It's hard to just say it's this one thing. But guaranteed, that is another variable in the problem.
Enterprise Intelligence is a Shiny Docs podcast with Jason Cassidy and Davey Sliman, produced by Stephen Schuntz, copyright 2024. If you would like to learn more about how Shiny Docs can make it easy to organize your content, protect your data, and make your users happy, visit shinydocs.com today.